Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. House Speaker Boehner says the Obama administration will be in violation of the War Powers Act by this weekend. Vice President Biden's group sets a July 1st deadline to reach an agreement on deficit reduction. And Congressman Anthony Weiner resigns. Joining me in the studio to talk about the week's top national stories, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, and Michael Shearer of Time Magazine, whom we welcome for the first time. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Sam.
All right, let's talk about the War Powers Act and Libya. Naftali, tell me about the partisan wrangling going on here.
Well, one of the interesting things about this is that it's not entirely partisan. There's this group of conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats that are coming together, sort of these anti-war Democrats and kind of fiscally conservative Republicans who are saying that they want more of a say in what's going on in Libya. And this restlessness that we're seeing in Congress is not just about Libya. It's also about Afghanistan. And so a bipartisan group sued the president the other day, claiming he was in violation of the War Powers Act. But I think that lawsuit is never going to really see fruition. What that lawsuit was more important for was that it reflects this growing angst on the part of Congress about what the president's doing.
But at the same time, Gene Cummings, didn't Boehner take a different position during the Bush administration?
Well, he absolutely did, and the White House has been very happy to bring back some of the Boehner's greatest hits from those years in the Bush administration. And they pointed out that that he had said that the actual law itself, the War Powers Act, was, quote, constitutionally suspect. And this was in 1999. And so clearly he was at a point where and throughout the early 2000s, where he wanted to be supported of the Bush administration. And so he adopted a different position and now is calling into question whether President Obama needs to go to Congress to get some authority for what's happening in Libya, especially given that it's costing the United States a lot of money. And, you know, one could argue that his position today is a better position for the House leader, because the House is the primary driver of spending, of government spending, and he is now in a capacity where he's the top shepherd of that spending, and he wants some accountability for it.
So, Michael Shearer, what are the options for Congress?
They still do have the power of the purse, but these sorts of fights have been fought many times before. Presidents routinely push back against Congress. Congress makes a political fuss. I mean, it's not just Boehner who's changed sides on this. President Obama, remember, in 2007, was the one leading this Democratic charge against the executive power to go to war unilaterally. Now he's defending it by saying these hostilities don't count as an actual war, sort of redefining what a hostility is. But Congress still has the power of the purse, but what's most likely to happen is that this ends in a stalemate, that this will play out as a political question. Republicans will score their points. Those on the left will score their points, and then we'll move on.
The White House is saying that it really did not require the War Powers Act because you don't have U.S. troops involved.
Yeah, I mean, that's their argument. They have a number of very acclaimed lawyers making the argument. Although if you look back at the 1973 War Powers Act, it very broadly defines what hostilities are. You know, it says hostilities in a foreign country. Now, the White House is saying that because there's no boots on the ground, because the bombing runs that are being run by American equipment are very limited, this doesn't count. But it is, I think, an effective redefinition of what a hostility is.
Another key point the White House is making is that it's NATO-led, mm-hmm. that it's right. not U.S.-led, and that in and of itself redefines what's happening here.
And the president is having a golf outing tomorrow with John Boehner, so could that help the situation of Tali?
Well, I mean, I do think that most likely this is going to end up in this strange sort of standoff. I mean, the history of the War Powers Act is interesting in that it was first enacted in 1973 during the Vietnam War, and ever since then, people have been wondering whether it's actually constitutional. But no president actually wants to challenge it directly, so they find ways to skate around it, and I think this is the latest chapter in that. Now, there's also a move afoot in the Senate, of all things, led in part by John McCain, to have a resolution of approval. So this standoff could actually, we could see a situation where the House is on record opposing it, the Senate's on record, including some leading Republicans, supporting it, President Obama just kind of going ahead and doing what he's going to do. I think the best thing that could happen for President Obama would be if Gaddafi somehow is deposed or is forced out, and then that would solve the whole thing. But until that happens, I think we're going to end up at this sort of back and forth, but no clear resolution.
Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, Michael Shearer of Time Magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Gene Cummings, give us an update on the negotiations regarding the federal debt.
Well, I wish I could tell you some great detail, but these guys are really keeping it close to the vest. What we do know is that they have said that they are having very productive meetings. They are aiming for between $2 and $4 trillion over the course of a time frame they haven't told us, 10 to 12 years of reduction in spending, which is a goal that appears to be one that they are united on. That would give the Republicans something they needed and give the White House a good credential when they go out. There is there are indications that Republicans in the negotiations are willing to see some revenue increases, but not tax increases, but to get rid of some tax breaks that might add some revenue into the mix, which is something that the White House and the Democrats have insisted upon. And maybe some smaller innovations to Medicare, but nothing like the proposal that came out of the House.
Who is actually involved in these negotiations?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I mean, Vice President Biden is leading them,
right.
But you also have representatives of House Democrats, House Republicans, Senate Democrats, and Senate Republicans. Chris Van Hollen, Jim Clyburn, Eric Cantor, John Kyle, Dan Inouye, and Max Baucus. So leading members of both sides. But there's a growing feeling that at some point, John Boehner and Barack Obama are going to have to step in and nail down the final details. You mentioned the golf game. Who knows if that'll be a step along the way. But even people who are in the room sort of say, well, we can get only so far, but tough decisions are going to have to be made, and ultimately the big boys are going to have to make them. Now, when that happens is an interesting question. I mean, the nations will begin defaulting on its obligations on August 2nd, but I think well before that, the markets are going to start getting jittery about a possible default. And I think when you see the markets looking like they're starting to get nervous, I think that might be the sign for these guys to suddenly sit down and come up with something pretty quickly.
Didn't Vice President Biden say he hopes to get this resolved by July 1? Michael?
Well, he hopes to come up with some document, some package that he can then hand off to the president, the speaker, and Senator Reid. I think these sort of negotiations always follow a playbook that everybody stakes out their position, people feel each other out, and then it's only in the 11th hour that the deal gets done. And that's the way this is going to go as well. There's even been discussion of the White House trying to push for some stimulus to add at the last minute here. Again, no one's going to know whether that's going to happen until the 11th hour when everybody's in the room and the markets are reacting.
What about this vote to cut millions from food safety? Is that part of this whole thing?
Well, I think it's part of the preliminary. That's sort of a follow-up to the Paul Ryan budget, and this is now the appropriations or spending bills that actually put those cuts into effect. And certainly the Democrats and Republicans are arguing, you know, vociferously about the cuts in that bill. But I think whatever is come up with will be superseded by whatever deal Obama and Boehner reach. So this is some preliminary skirmishing, and it's certainly arousing some strong emotions. But I think ultimately it's going to be overtaken by events.
Tell me about the Senate ethanol vote.
I think it was a pretty historic vote. You had 34 Republicans going on the record for eliminating a tax expenditure, which is effectively raising taxes. If you talk to Grover Norquist, who is the sort of conservative general in charge of holding the Republican line on taxes, he says you can't raise these taxes unless you lower taxes elsewhere. And still, 34 Republicans went on the record saying they want to get rid of these tax, essentially loopholes for a specific industry. Democrats are saying, and I think they have a point, that this signals clearly that tax expenditures are now on the table. The Democratic line has been from the beginning in these debt limit negotiations that we need to have some revenues to talk about. And here Republicans in the Senate are demonstrating, well, there are some revenues we can talk about. We can work with you on this.
How significant are these revenues?
Well, they're not going to solve the debt limit negotiations. They're not going to be $2 to $4 trillion.
but that both the food safety and ethanol, to bring them together, they are signals to the negotiators about what's acceptable, right, and what's not. It gives them signals about what they can wrap in. And a Senate vote, a bipartisan Senate vote that big, is so rare, right, that I think if I were in the ethanol industry, I'd be highly concerned that I was going to end up on the cutting table.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember what ethanol has sort of represented over the years. It's, you know, I mean, this subsidy has been in place since the late 70s, and it's a, you know, an aid or assistance to a particular group of producers and farmers and refiners, and it has a lot to do with the farm states and lawmakers from those states. And every 4 years, we see candidates go to Iowa to promise to preserve the ethanol subsidy. And so now we're seeing this rising concern about federal spending. And the idea that such a broad coalition would vote in favor of removing that is a real signal that times have changed. And so I think that's maybe the bigger significance of the vote, even more than the actual money that would be
saved.
Even
on the campaign trail, when Republicans, as they tour Iowa now, the line is no longer, I will defend ethanol to the death. It is, we're going to phase this out over a number of years, and we'll work out the details later. So even among Republican candidates, it's been an issue.
Michael Scherer, White House correspondent for Time magazine. Short break, and we'll open the phones soon after we come back. And welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Jean Cummings. She's Deputy Government Editor for Bloomberg News. Michael Scherer is White House Correspondent for Time magazine. Naftali Ben-David is National Correspondent with The Wall Street Journal. Your calls, your comments are always welcome. Here's an email from Keith in Boston, who says, I've heard Republicans are demanding a dollar of spending cuts for every dollar in the increase of the spending limit. If that's true, why aren't Democrats demanding a dollar in increased revenue for every dollar in spending cuts? Naftali.
Well, that's true. That is what the Republicans are demanding. I mean, one thing we should clarify is that those spending cuts might come over a long period of time. In other words, let's say over 10 years, whereas the increase in the debt limit would just cover the next couple years. But I think the reason that the Democrats are not doing that is simply that politically, that's a very difficult thing to sustain, to talk about that kind of an increase in revenue at this period, in this political climate. I think that's something that would be hard for them to do.
And here's another email from Adam in Roanoke. He says, people are saying the current economic woes bode poorly for President Obama. Is it too early to tell? Is the current economic environment likely to persist through 2012? Michael.
I was over at the White House a couple weeks ago talking about this very matter. They are not speaking much publicly on this, but it's clear that their knuckles are white and they're holding on and hoping that the second two quarters of this year show real improvements, that the slowdown we saw over the last month doesn't continue. No matter what happens, it's going to be a very difficult election year for Obama because he's going to be going into a reelection with higher unemployment than any president basically since FDR has had. The question is whether by the end of this year and early next year, the American people tangibly feel in their daily lives an improvement. And that's what people don't feel right now. And that's why Obama has a real problem.
Do you think the president knew how bad it was when he first got into it, Jean?
I do think that they figured it out in the fall before he took office. In the fall before he took office, in the months of October, November, December, those final months of campaigning, the economy started shedding 500,000 jobs a month. It was extraordinary. It was historic. And it was a spiral that frightened them to no end. It is one of the reasons that Obama came back to town off the campaign trail to support the rescuing of the financial banks that were all in trouble. And it is a reason that the start of his term was with the stimulus. They wanted to immediately go in and try to find a way to stop the bleeding in the job market. Now, they had hoped that by this time the recovery would be more robust. And economists across the board say this has been a very slow recovery. And if you look at recessions going back the last couple of decades, the recoveries are all getting slower and slower, in part because businesses learn over the course of the recession that they can do without.
Leaner is meaner.
Exactly. They can do more with less, and so they are slower to rehire. Now, are things set in stone, as Adam asked? No, they aren't, but things don't look good right now because the recovery appears to have stalled a bit right now. And as Michael said, they're really hoping for a rebound towards the end of the year. If you look historically at presidential campaigns, talk to polling experts, they say that it is June of the election year that voters kind of make up their minds about where the country is economically.
So
they got a little bit of time. But they, as Michael said, they got to see some movement out there.
Naftali.
Yeah, I mean, I think they clearly thought things would be better. They said unemployment wouldn't go over 8%, and that turned out not to be true. And they also talked about last summer as recovery summer, which is a thing I think they would not have said had they known how the economy would play out. But one thing that they've done recently is they've floated the idea of extending this payroll tax break for a little bit longer. And to me,
employers and employees.
Exactly. And I think that they did that because they're desperate almost for some sort of stimulative action they can take. They know they probably would like to spend more on things like infrastructure. They know that's a non-starter with the Republicans. So this is something they think they can do. So to me, just floating that signaled the eagerness with which they're looking for something they can do to help turn the economy around.
What I keep wondering about, Naftali, is how do they pay it back?
Well, that's a good question. And one of the things that's been striking about it is the Republican response, which has been so incredibly lukewarm. Now, ordinarily, you'd expect Republicans to respond very positively to any sort of a tax break. But Paul Ryan derided it as a sugar high, you know, because he said it's just temporary, as though Republicans haven't supported temporary tax breaks in the past. They've also asked the question you're asking, which is, where will the offset come from? And there's some concern about we're trying to close the deficit. A tax break like this would increase the deficit. But truth be told, I think part of the reason for the Republican response is this is something Obama suggested that he thinks would be good for him, and so they are naturally wary of
it's
and are going to oppose it.
Yeah. Michael, politics.
Yeah, I mean, just 2 months ago, John Boehner went to the New York Economic Club and gave a big policy address in which he said, the short-term stimulus era is over. We're not going back. It didn't work. Now, Republicans have sort of defined themselves as a policy matter as the party that doesn't believe stimulus works, even though if you talk to 99 out of 100 economists, they will say the stimulus that have been passed over the last several years have had significant effects on the economy and on the unemployment rate. Republicans argued in 2010, and they will argue again in 2012, that what Obama did failed. If they embrace at this point another short-term stimulus measure, which again could happen, but it would happen in the 11th hour, they're going to be sort of confusing their own argument among their voters.
And what about big cuts to Medicaid? They look as though they're now on the table.
Well, I think that there are very few government programs that are going to come out of this negotiation without being touched. And part of what's driving these negotiations from the White House perspective is the economy. There is an argument that is being made in the business community and among economists that one of the reasons that there's not as much investment and growth in the job market and in expansion of businesses is because they want to see what Washington is going to do about the deficit.
So they're holding back.
So they're holding back. They don't know what their taxes are going to be. They don't know what the regs are going to be. You know, some uncertainty is always in the marketplace, but there's a lot of uncertainty right now because these negotiations are happening right now. So if there is a final deal, that might create some sense of, okay, now I know for the next 10 years, this kind of the flight plan that the government has set for itself, and now maybe I can begin investing again. That is one of the major motivators for Biden in these negotiations.
But, of course, you've got Ben Bernanke's warning out there. You've got lots of people warning, do not let this debt ceiling pass without really fixing the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems that Democrats, Republicans, economists face that there's this group of Republicans that I don't think anybody really expected that's just saying that it really doesn't matter if we don't raise the debt limit at all. And it'll be just fine. And there are ways to rearrange our expenditures.
Where does that thinking come from?
My sense is that it comes from a couple of places. For one thing, there's a deep suspicion among some of these people, among almost any kind of authority or expertise or anything like that. They feel also like they were stampeded into things like TARP and like the stimulus because economists kept predicting calamity if they didn't pass. Now, those predictions may have been correct, but nonetheless, I think there's a feeling amongst, particularly this Tea Party group, although it's not limited to them, that you can't trust what these guys say. They always say this stuff. They always try to get us to vote for things by predicting catastrophe, and we're not necessarily going to go along with it this time. Now, I think Congress will pass an increase in the debt limit because John Boehner and Eric Cantor and others realize that it does need to be raised, but they're going to have to do it with Democratic support because a healthy percentage of Republicans, I think, aren't going to vote for that, for raising the debt ceiling, no matter what.
Michael.
Yeah, I think, and that makes this negotiation far more interesting because Eric Cantor can't come to the table and say, this is what I want. I've got the votes to pass it. This is the only way to do it. He's got to actually ask Nancy Pelosi for, you know, 30, 40, I don't know exactly what the number is, Democratic votes. And that means that both sides play. The other thing I would say about the debt limit is there is a lot of precedent for protest votes on the debt limit. Barack Obama, again, during a campaign season before he became president, issued a protest vote. It wasn't a vote that was going to swing the bill one way or the other, but he voted against raising the debt limit as a protest against the way the negotiations have been held.
All right, let's move on to the resignation of Anthony Weiner.
Finally.
Michael, share what impact does that have, not only on his career, but on Democrats generally?
Well, Democrats are waking up this morning feeling far better about the political landscape than they have the last several weeks. Weiner had become a real bag of sand weighing them down, distracting from their message, getting them off track. He stepped out of the limelight. I think it was really interesting if you watched his press conference yesterday. He stepped out of the limelight in the most ostentatious way he could possibly do by holding another press conference. And I think that suggests that even though Weiner's political career, at least for the immediate future, is over, the public may not have seen the last of him. He seems to have a uncontrollable desire to be in front of cameras.
And he apparently has a good following among his own constituents. That's right. There's even talk he may run for mayor.
Yeah, he could still run for mayor. I think he needs to lay low for a while and see where the polls go for a while. His congressional district is almost certainly going to be eliminated in the next round of redistricting. So he doesn't really have a seat to go back to at this point, and mayor may be the next choice. But honestly, if I were to bet right now, I think his most likely route is to go into broadcast journalism of some sort and become a sort of professional pundit. Even when he was in the House, he loved the television cameras, and he was on television far more than his colleagues, and he was actually very good at it. I mean, the shout fest that is cable television right now, he was pretty good at engaging on that level, and that would be my guess.
It's ironic that was his rise and fall, because he wasn't all that well known until he went ahead and did the cable network route. And he's quick, he's funny, and he is very good on TV, and that is what elevated his stature in the House, and then ultimately that is what led to his downfall, because it was the relentlessness of the exposure of what he was doing. There wasn't one picture, there were more and more and more, and all of that playing out under the 24-hour news cycle that we live in today was what drove him out the door.
Neftali.
Yeah, that press conference was really something else. I mean, I think 99 out of 100 politicians would have issued a brief statement saying, I resign. And the fact that he chose to do it was fascinating in a way. And then he got heckled at his own farewell press conference. He got heckled and called a pervert by some people who were there. And why he'd subjected himself to that isn't clear, except for this need perhaps to be out there. But I think the broader political message is this: is Democrats, their relief was just palpable when this happened. I mean, they felt like they, for the first time in 2 years, had a little bit of political momentum with this Medicare plan and with winning a seat in upstate New York. And then to have this blow up and then to have the guy not step off the stage and to resist leaving, I think was driving them crazy. And it was a concerted, unified, high-profile effort by his own party to get him to leave that ultimately he couldn't resist.
And what? Very coordinated. That's what I found interesting in the story, is to see how they pushed him to the door. And you speak of the polls in his own district that are positive, and he used that as an argument with Speaker Pelosi about why he could maybe ride this thing out. And her line was beautiful: let them be the rose petals to your exit. I thought that was poetry in a way that we don't see in politics very often, while you're shoving somebody out of office.
What about the special election to fill his seat?
What's almost certain to happen is that the governor of New York will declare a special election, most likely for September, when other voting will be going on in New York. The way politics works in New York is that the candidate is going to most likely be picked by the political machine there, the Democratic candidate, and then it'll be a Republican candidate. But at this point, it's not a really desirable position, because that seat is probably going to exist for maybe 18 more months before it is eliminated in redistricting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key thing about it, is they have to find somebody who really wants to be in Congress and is willing to go out there and run an election and have a fight and get there, and then is perfectly happy to leave a year and a half later. And that's going to be a big challenge.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let me ask you, Neftali, what was the biggest takeaway from the Republican debate?
Well, a lot of people noticed that people didn't attack each other very much, and specifically that Tim Pawlenty didn't attack Mitt Romney as he'd been expected to do. And this did come off as less of a debate, maybe more of a showcase, where people were so concerned with presenting themselves positively that you didn't have the usual back and forth. And I do think, people felt like Mitt Romney came out well because of that. Michelle Bachmann presented herself well. But I think the bar was pretty low. I mean, all they really had to do is sort of show up and seem intelligent and engaging, and they did. But the thing that I think is important to remember is this is the first of many, many debates. And if the next one, if there are fireworks, we all will have forgotten about this one. So I guess I wouldn't take away too much from this one.
But this one, they were really focused on attacking the president.
They were. First impressions are important. And It is, you know, Romney didn't hurt himself. Bachman did well. But I think that Tim Pawlenty's decision to pull his punch against Romney in the days after became increasingly significant, to the point where he now is admitting that it was a mistake. And I think
term he had coined and then backed away from?
It was Obamacare.
There we go, Obamacare. Yeah, and he used it, and this was a reference to the Massachusetts health care law and the national health care law. He used it on the Sunday talk shows and then went in on Monday. His team was pitching, touting that he was going to bring it back. He was going to bring it to the stage. And when CNN's John King asked him directly about it, he flinched.
Why?
That's his reputation and that's his weakness, that he's too nice to run. And he walked right into a trap there in that he confirmed what people's fear was about him.
Michael.
I think if you were Mitt Romney's campaign advisors a year ago and you were trying to imagine the perfect first debate, it would include the following. It would include Tim Pawlenty tripping on himself and falling over and having a rough time. It would include somebody like Michelle Bachman, who has a shot at winning Iowa and taking out someone like Tim Pawlenty, having a great day, and the debate being focused largely or almost entirely on Barack Obama and the economy. And that's exactly what happened.
Michael Scherer of Time Magazine, short break. And when we come back, we'll open the phones. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
You've heard the headlines. Now find out what they mean for you. Top journalists offer expert insight and analysis of the week's major news stories. Join us for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to open the phones first to Flint, Michigan. Good morning, Bryce. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm hoping there could be some discussion about this outrageous supposed quip of Romney's the other day that he is also unemployed. Coming from someone with $200 million, it's just insulting. But to add insult, you know, to the injury, this is someone who is against government-sponsored unemployment benefits.
Michael.
If you follow Mitt Romney around the campaign trail, he is constantly making jokes, and they are constantly of the Ward Cleaver variety. There's this sort of 1950s antiquated, hokey humor. Mitt Romney has made this joke about I'm unemployed a number of times. He was making it in 2010. Nobody was picking up on it before. It's a joke about himself. It's clear from the reporting that it was a joke about himself. But in the heat of a presidential battle,
where not a good time,
where a soundbite can be taken and twisted in whatever way, it's clearly going to come across as something that he was mocking workers and not mocking his own
wife. What about his comments regarding climate change, Michael?
You know, Mitt Romney has also, I think, sort of excelled in being one of these candidates who is able to speak the rhetoric of the partisan wing of the party while keeping his positions far more complex and moderate. And he's going to be one of these candidates who is not ruling out the possibility that man-made climate change is an issue. That said, I don't know if it's a deal breaker. You know, Tim Pawlenty was at one point in his career for cap and trade, although he since said he's sorry. John Huntsman has also supported, a cap and trade system.
And he's likely to get into the race on Tuesday.
That's right. And Newt Gingrich has also. I mean, the political conversation on climate change has changed so dramatically in the last decade that anybody who's been around long enough was once on the other side of this issue. So I don't really see it as being a turning point in the race.
All right. Here's an email from Susan in Guilford, Connecticut, who says, I read this morning Mr. Ryan's budget bill creates vouchers for the elderly to obtain medical insurance, cuts to education, also preserves lucrative tax subsidies for oil, mining, and energy industries that would be personally beneficial to him and his in-laws. Isn't this a conflict of interest? It's in the Daily Beast this morning.
It is. And it is true that his in-laws own property that they lease to oil companies for mining purposes. And so they have an indirect benefit from any subsidies that, you know, help maintain the oil industry. And this comes to light because this week the members of Congress had to release their 2011 personal financial disclosure reports. And if you look at those reports, what you find is that there are lots and lots of congressmen, Democrats and Republicans, who have a wide array of investments. Ryan is among the more wealthy members of the House, so he has more investments, and they're all diversified. And so they do have some energy, and they do have financials, and they have interests in a lot of companies that do have interests before Capitol Hill. Now, what Ryan has said is when he was putting together his budget, he made decisions based on public policy, not based on his portfolio. And you know, that's true for every member of Congress. And all we could do is pretty much take them on their word because there are no rules against it.
Neptel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, everybody knows where Paul Ryan stands on these things. And he stood where he stands for a long time. And, there are a lot of members of Congress on both sides that have these kind of investments. Nancy Pelosi is extremely wealthy as well. One thing that was interesting to me about these financial disclosures is that so many of the Republican freshmen are millionaires. It's 19 or something like that. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with that, but they ran so much as being men of the people. It was really populist. It was against the elites. And so to the extent that many of them actually are pretty well established financially, I mean, again, nothing wrong with it, but it's a little bit of maybe a surprise given what their message was.
All right. To Wentzville, Missouri. Good morning, Steve.
Hello. My comment is that I think that they put a lot of weight on the president for creating jobs whenever anybody would know that the wealthy Republicans are sitting on the boards of large companies, and it's up to them whether they hire or work overtime. I pick up mufflers out of a place in Kentucky, and they've worked their people 2 12-hour shifts ever since last Thanksgiving that I know of.
Michael.
I think you're getting at something that the White House has been saying and the Obama campaign will say is that this election is not just going to be a referendum on Obama's record. It's going to be a choice between what Republicans have done and are promising to do and what Obama has done and is promising to do. And it is true that Republicans still don't have a really convincing answer when it comes to jobs. The House has this 11-page document with lots of pictures and very large font about their jobs plan. But it's basically a list of stuff they've always wanted anyway. It's not really specifically targeted to the current situation we're in. Mitt Romney is going to be running this campaign, and other candidates I think will follow him, solely on, you know, whether Obama has failed America's economy and America's workers. And at some point, Republicans are going to have to present, okay, here is my vision. And if the vision amounts to more tax cuts for very wealthy people and the sort of laundry list of stuff that has been done for a long time, including, you know, major cuts to government programs that help people who are unemployed or who don't have money, I think Obama's going to be able to get some traction there.
Gene, one person we didn't mention in regard to the debate was Newt Gingrich. Why is he now demanding an apology from NBC?
Well, Gingrich has had such a terrible week. He probably is looking for apologies all around. I don't know exactly why he wants NBC to apologize to him. I just know that his campaign is so far off the tracks that it's difficult for a lot of people to focus on him as a serious candidate anymore at all.
Do you agree with that, Naftali?
Yeah, I do. He was involved this week in sort of disparaging his own campaign staff. And I think that's not a situation you want to be in. But a very large number of them, 17 or something like that, resigned recently because they were unhappy with his lack of discipline in his campaign. And so he was in the position of saying, well, they just don't understand. All they know is about 30-second attack ads. I'm a man of big ideas. And so it raises a lot of questions. First of all, why did he hire them? And what does it say about his judgment if they were that bad? But secondly, I don't think you ever want to be in a situation of disparaging your own people. And he was making mistakes from the beginning, whether it was attacking Paul Ryan in the way he did, whether it was trying to explain his own affair. And this is just one sort of last explosion in his campaign.
Go ahead, Michael.
It's a new political technique, the big brain defense. When the press first came after him, after he flubbed on Meet the Press and conservatives were angry, he said, the press just doesn't understand a campaign about big ideas. Their brains are too small. When his campaign staff left, he said, my campaign staff didn't understand a philosophical campaign about big ideas. It's a strategy. Mm-hmm. He's got one. I don't think it's going to work.
But the apology was asked for or demanded because there was a report which cited complaints from unnamed former advisors that his wife, Calista, is actually to blame for the exodus of his whole staff.
Well, the blame the wife thing is a long-standing theme in Newt Gingrich's career. And this is the third wife, and now she's taken a rap. And the last two wives took their own fair share of blame along the way as well. Their argument was that she was controlling and she approved press releases and she was in charge of his schedule and all of that. But where is Newt Gingrich's acceptance of his responsibility for either criticizing Paul Ryan or not on Meet the Press and, you know, misspeaking or whatever and bringing all of that negativity onto his own campaign? He's responsible for his campaign. If she irritated people by, you know, picking on a press release, that's fine.
But Newt Gingrich is,
well, he could have said no. Newt Gingrich is responsible for his own campaign.
Okay, to Cortez, Florida. Good morning, Skip.
Morning, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I've got a question for your guests there. Over the last few days, your guests have made inferences to the fact that the Congress is doing such a good job. And based upon the status of this economy, I don't understand it. I look at the financials and the banks that have gone under and the banks that have been paying their executives exorbitant fees, and nobody's gone to jail. So just to have your guests tell me how Congress is doing such a good job.
Michael.
I certainly wouldn't be one to defend Congress. And the American people, I mean, congressional approval is maybe 15% today or 10% or 18%, but Congress has been, as a whole, as a body, as an institution, at the very bottom of national approval ratings for years. It's even gotten worse. People like their individual congressperson generally, but they don't like Congress as a whole. And And I think you're seeing, I mean, if there's a way out of this, it's that the American people do actually like it when the parties come together and they cut a big deal and they get to some agreement. And so there is a weird way in which Boehner and Obama have shared interest right now. They can both win through at the end of this debt limit debate. If they come out with a proposal, it'll help both of them. It'll help the institution as a whole. It's not a zero-sum game.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. I thank you for letting me be on. I'd like to say what the last two callers have said, that this jobs issue is not just an Obama issue or a Democratic issue. We have a party that came in, and their first thing was to defeat Obama. Congress, the Republicans haven't put forth a jobs program. Every jobs program that is put forth, it's killed in Congress. States, and especially our state in Ohio, our governor, you know, gives away. We get stimulus money. He says no to it. You know, it's just, I think the people now kind of get it. And it's not just your guest and distinguished guests, I might add. But I think sometimes the media says this is Obama's economy. And I think the people are kind of getting it now that, no, it's everyone's economy.
Interesting point.
Well, I do think that the Republicans have yet to figure out a way to take their aggressive focus on reducing the deficit and try to turn that into a jobs program. And they know they have that problem. They do think the two are linked. But I don't think the average voter has heard that message and understands that message, and I don't think they've made that case. And that will be a problem for them in the next reelect if they don't find a way around that corner. And I think the caller touched on something that's also a really interesting dynamic to watch, and that is what is happening out in these states like Ohio, critical swing state in the presidential. Governors are having a really hard time, and some of the Republican governors in particular are being very aggressive in terms of cutting jobs and things like that. And in the end, that will also become a part of the 2012 debate for the presidential.
Gene Cummings, Bloomberg News. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've had several emails on this, Ryan, conflict of interest. How important do you see it?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I really don't want to minimize it. I mean, I think it's very important that members of Congress are very open about what their personal, you know, interests are in legislation. But I do think that, you know, on the other hand, you can't automatically attribute bad motives to somebody because they have a certain policy position. And number two, isn't the issue really what's the right thing to do for the country, not what certain personal interests members of Congress have? So I think that, you know, the solution that we generally try to take is a lot of openness, a lot of exposure, so we know where people are coming from, but at the same time not disqualifying somebody from putting forth a budget as chairman of the Budget Committee because he does hold certain interests.
All right, and finally to Springfield, Virginia. Hi, Jean, you're on the air.
Yes, it's my belief that the uncertainty in the marketplace has been largely caused by the Republicans' total negativity. I would certainly like to know what they have done in the past 4 years that a good reason for why I should vote for them.
Michael.
I think you could argue that Republicans share a significant part of the blame for the current deficit situation, which arose partly because of the downturn, but also significantly because of the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003. The markets, you know, even if Republicans had been coming forward with very positive proposals or more positive proposals, or if they had been far more negative, the markets would be responding because the numbers right now just don't add up. This is a problem not of politics, but right now we are spending more and projected to spend far more than we are going to take in revenue, and we have to solve that. And it's just that's just math right now that is causing the markets to get jitters.
I mean, the Republicans have made it very clear that they believe that the best way to produce jobs is to cut taxes and cut regulations and to just have the government get out of the way.
But didn't we go through that once?
Well, that's the
before.
Democratic response. That not just once before, but for decades, you know, the Republicans come in and do this, and then the Democratic argument, at least, is that hasn't worked. And the Republicans say it has worked. Look at the Reagan years. years, but they're really not making that many bones about it. They don't think the government should be doing very much. In fact, the less, the better. And that's really broadly what their job is.
That's the whole point.
It is. And I think the real interesting dynamic politically in the next election is going to be, is it a referendum on Obama and whether or not he and the Democrats have succeeded or failed, or is it really going to be a comparison? And the party that better succeeds in putting forth their framework, I think, is going to be the party that does well.
Well, I would suspect that it's going to be a referendum on Obama. That's what almost every reelect campaign is. They'll try to make it into a choice. And in that respect, what the White House is doing now is what Obama sort of hinted at last fall when he agreed to the extension of the Bush tax cuts. He basically said, you know, I can't get rid of them now. I'm going to take this into the campaign. And I'm going to let people over the next 2 years see what happens. And so when this deficit plan comes out and there are big cuts to domestic programs, he'll be able to go out on the campaign trail and with more clarity, not you know, predicting terrible cuts, but with real cuts that have happened. And say to people who are getting, their police departments are getting less money, their teachers are getting less money, you know, all of their programs are underfunded, and say, okay, is this what you want, or do you think that wealthy people should pay a little bit more?
Last word, Michael.
I would say the president has a second challenge. There's the policy issue of how he's going to argue whether his policies are better than Republicans. He also has a connection issue, which I think is becoming more pronounced, and Republicans are going to exploit. He has not been able to demonstrate that he can identify with the person who's out of work and who's been out of work for a long time.
Michael Shearer of Time Magazine, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, Naftali Ben-David, Wall Street Journal. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.